From the studios of Boise State Public Radio, I'm Gemma Gaudette. It's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. This is, of course, when we get you up to date on all of the news that have made headlines this last week in our region. And today, our panel includes Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with Idaho Statesman, Nate Eaton, news director at eastidahonews.com, Rachel Spachek with the Idaho Statesman, and Madeline Beck, Mountain West News Bureau reporter with Boise State Public Radio. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday.
So, Nate, I want to start today's conversation with you and talk about the latest in the Lori and Chad Daybell case. There are two questions. So the first one, what is the latest in regards to cameras being allowed in the courtroom?
Well, we are waiting on Judge Stephen Boies to issue a ruling. You might recall a few weeks ago after one of the court appearances where Lori was smiling and laughing and grinning, her defense attorneys within days filed a motion to have cameras banned from the courtroom, saying that the media abused the privilege of being there and that even if a camera was allowed, it should be a still camera in the jury box that isn't able to zoom in on anything. East Idaho News joined 32 other media outlets, including many of the people on the panel today and the Associated Press and other national outlets to fight this motion. And a hearing was held about a week ago, and the judge did have some, serious questions about why cameras should be in the courtroom and microphones on the defense table and the prosecutor's table. And he said he would take it under advisement and issue a written ruling. Of course, this is a case that has been followed around the world. There's a Netflix special out on this case as we speak that's been in the top 10. So it has a lot of publicity. A lot of people want to follow every development of this trial, but her defense team and the prosecution as well, they don't want cameras in the courtroom.
Okay, so we're still waiting for that. And then my other question, Nate, which I'm surprised by this, is that the remains of J.J. Valo and Tylee Ryan have not been released to their family members?
Yeah, so these children were found, it's been over 2 years now, June of 2020, in Chad Daybell's backyard. And they are still, an autopsy was performed in Boise, and then the bodies were brought back, and they're being stored in a freezer, for lack of a better term, because the trial, both sides have the right to do further DNA testing on these bodies. And JJ's grandfather came out last week and said, we want to bury him, we want to hold a memorial service for him, and ask the court to release the bodies. Unfortunately, the court can't unless the prosecution and the defense agree that, yes, we've done all the testing we need. But that could even, carry on after the trial in case there's appeals or they need some sort of evidence. So those bodies still are being held in custody of the state. And it might be some time until the families actually get to bury the bodies or cremate them or, lay them to rest.
And Nate, so at this point, the trial is still set for January in Ada County, correct?
Yeah, it's supposed to begin January 9th. It's expected to be 10 weeks in Ada County. It is a death penalty case on both sides. I would not be surprised if the defense maybe asked for a little bit more time. Lori's defense team is fairly new to this case. They've been on it less than a year because she had another attorney and then she was declared incompetent. So for a capital case, they've really got to do a lot of extensive research and the bar is higher when the death penalty is at stake. So it is scheduled for January. I wouldn't be surprised though if maybe it's delayed until the spring. With that being said, Lori Vallow would need to sign away her right to a speedy trial and she has not done that. Chad Daybell has, Lori has not.
All right. And are they at this point, Nate, still being tried together?
They are. They are being tried together. There's going to be a lot of this. Well, it is the same witnesses, the same evidence. However, if there's a delay with one of the defendants, the other one might say, no, I want to move it forward.
Okay. All right. We will wait. And then for that decision by the judge in regards to the cameras, as we continue to wait for this case to come to trial. Rachel, I want to switch gears and talk about the city of Starr for a minute. You recently wrote a piece that they're struggling to fund police as their city keeps growing. And this goes back to a decision that was made in the legislature.
Yes. So I imagine, lots of reporters came on this show and talked about this about two sessions ago. It was this kind of rushed through property tax bill. It was, you know, it came from Representative Mike Moyle from Star. So it's kind of interesting that the city of Star is the one that's struggling with this. So basically it tried to lower property taxes by capping city budgets. And, you know, at the time cities were opposed to it, saying, you know, we need these means to pay for the growth in our city. And, you know, because it's not just Star, it's everywhere, you know, more people are coming to the city. And so they require more services, more stuff for the city to pay for. So it makes sense that the cities, you know, want all of their means to pay for this. And that's what the city of Star is essentially struggling with. You know, they have been growing like crazy out there. And since they can only take an 8% increase in their overall budget after this law was passed, you know, they don't have any money to hire the police that they need. They want to have a 4-minute response time for fire as well. And they want to have one police officer for each 1,000 residents. And right now they're below that. And so basically what they've turned to, and this is in lieu of, you know, some kind of limit on building permits, is they've decided to add fees to each permit to pay for police and fire. So it would be $1,120 for police services and $1,200 for fire. And so the city council is thinking about this, and they're going to vote on it at their next meeting, October 4th. But and they said that the city said that they're working closely with the Idaho Building Contractors Association to, you know, try to make permanent amendments to this law in the coming session. So again, you know, we'll see what happens there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're just going to have to wait then until this next city council meeting in a week or so.
Yeah.
Scott, I want to talk a little bit about, I guess for lack of a better word, virtual meetings. This is something that when the pandemic hit, basically I think everybody's lives kind of became virtual in a lot of ways, in particular work. So what's going on now in regards to the state of Idaho and keeping some of these meetings virtual, and then the price tag that comes along with this?
Yeah, well, it turns out that some state agencies are actually getting away from doing live streaming of their meetings. The Commission for Pardons and Parole is going to stop doing live meetings in November. The Percy Retirement Board stopped doing live meetings in March. And, you know, we're coming out of the pandemic. And so these agencies are saying, well, you know, we don't need to do these virtually anymore. But really, it's really been a tremendous public service to be able to watch these meetings virtually. You know, I talked to a reader who lives in Caldwell and was watching the Percy board meetings remotely in Boise and didn't want to drive into Boise for their meetings, and enjoyed watching them online. And the other benefit too is that you can watch them later. So if you live stream them, then you record them and then post them, and you can watch them anytime you want. But some state agencies are getting rid of them because we're out of the pandemic. And so I was arguing that they should keep on doing it. I'm not saying get rid of the in-person meetings, keep doing the in-person option, but still live stream it. And I talked to a few agencies, Central District Health. They really don't pay anything. They stream their meetings on YouTube and it doesn't cost anything. And the storage is handled by YouTube, and people can go back and watch back meetings anytime they want and tune in from wherever they want. The city of Nampa, they pay something like $2,400 a year for the live streaming service, and they had to upgrade some of their equipment. And then it turns out in the last legislative session, pretty quietly, the legislature approved $2 million to go into the permanent building fund to help state agencies pay for upgrades and equipment and buy cameras and audio equipment. And they're still working out how they're gonna spend that money and how they're going to divvy that money up. So we don't know yet exactly. No one's applied for it yet because they haven't set up that system. But there's $2 million sitting there for agencies to upgrade their systems and keep doing live streaming of their meetings. And so I think it would be a tremendous benefit if agencies and city councils and planning board and school boards continue doing live streaming, even though they don't necessarily have to, they still should.
Well, and Scott, what I find interesting as well is that if you look at it from the state level, right, let's take a state agency. Those state agencies are, for the most part, all located in Boise.
Yeah.
We have numerous people that do not live in Boise, that do not live in the Treasure Valley. This allows access that, frankly, they didn't have even before the pandemic.
Right. And some of these state agencies, to their credit, do road shows. They go on the road and they go to Lewiston and they go to smaller towns all over the state. But you think about how expensive that is. And you know, again, people might not be able to get out to those road shows. And now with live streaming, you can watch from anywhere. And I looked, and there's only about 3/4 of the state agencies right now that have a live stream option. And yeah, it's just a benefit. And you look at the legislature allowing remote testimony now, and people can testify from any part of the state directly without having to come down to Boise to the state capitol for committees. It's just been a great, if you can say anything good came out of the pandemic, that is certainly one of them, and they should keep doing it.
Right. And Madeline, you know, the pandemic also saw a record number of people adopting pets. You're stuck at home, you know, a lot of people living alone, need a companion, et cetera. But we're seeing a real shift now. Talk to us about what's going on with this.
Yeah, so we're unfortunately seeing a major pendulum shift the opposite direction. You'll see a lot of shelters now are back to being completely full. And unfortunately, that also means euthanizations are going up, which, you know, it's something that a lot of us do not want to see. We don't like hearing about. A lot of them are older pets that may not be adopted. And so one of the reasons that is was there was recent research out of the University of Florida where they found that there was, you know, a slump in the amount of spay and neuter surgeries available. Obviously, you know, shutdowns were part of that. But what's come out of the pandemic as well is a shortage of veterinarians and vet techs and more of those vets and vet techs moving into jobs that have more set hours. You know, they don't want to work the overtime anymore. And that means if, you know, you have fewer people working those more hours, you have, you know, fewer availabilities, fewer folks want to work in the nonprofit space where they're spay and neutering more pets. You know, just strays on the streets or doing free clinics. Even people that have pets right now might realize that it's taking a few more weeks than they'd expect to get their pet spay or neutered. It's, you know, it's because of the same shortage. So that's one of the things that they think is going into this. But, you know, anecdotally, I've seen around, you know, Southern Idaho as well, people facing, you know, housing shortages. If they have to move into a new place that doesn't allow pets, they've been, you know, putting up their pet into shelters, or, you know, they don't have a home anymore, or they need to stay at, you know, one of our homeless shelters in town that don't allow pets. Those are some of the things affecting that. Obviously, exactly how much any one of these factors is affecting this surge in pets is unknown. We can't really know that at the moment, but we do know it's happening. And so a lot of these folks that are experts in the field are recommending, you know, if you can host a pet or, you know, adopt a pet or even just, you know, donate to your local shelter, they need it now more than ever. You know, we've reduced the number of euthanizations in the United States from about 13.5 million in 1973 to 1.5 million in 2019. But now, for the first time in that length of time, we are now seeing that trend reverse. We are seeing more euthanizations.
Oh, well, I hope, you know, just getting the word out will help. And if people can help out, it would certainly make a huge difference. Clark, I want to bring you into the conversation now. Believe it or not, we are just a bit more than 6 weeks out from Election Day. So I want to pick your brain, Clark, on what you've been tracking. But let's start with Governor Little once again not participating in a debate.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Gemma, for having me on. And I'll invite Scott or anybody else on the show today to jump in as well. But that was kind of the big news earlier this week as we look ahead to the November 8th general election, which is a big election here in Idaho and a big election across the country. It's the midterms nationally, but in Idaho, we have all of our statewide offices like governor and lieutenant governor, secretary of state, school superintendent up, as well as all 105 seats in the legislature. So it's a big election coming up in Idaho. But once again, incumbent governor Brad Little has declined to participate in the traditional statewide televised debates. The Idaho debates that our friend Melissa Davlin from Idaho Public Television and Betsy Russell from the Idaho Press Club are helping to produce and to run this year. And this, if this sounds familiar, it's because this just happened before the primary elections in May. Mm-hmm. Governor Little also declined to debate his opponents leading up to the primary election. And so what this means is it means the governor's debate has been canceled. There's not going to be a statewide governor's debate. And we also had our two members of the U.S. House of Representatives, Representative Russ Fulcher and Representative Mike Simpson, are also declining to debate their opponents. And so that resulted in the cancellation of those two debates as well. It's kind of a bad deal for voters. I think a lot of us on the show today enjoy the debates and appreciate the fact to put the candidates in front of a large audience, have them defend their record, talk about their policies and goals. And so we're going to miss out on that with these several debates that have been canceled. I can talk in a couple of minutes about the debates that will go forward that have been scheduled. Mm-hmm. But I think the interesting thing about debates, especially as we get into social media and some of the concerns with information that you see published on social media, the debates, the idea is to have some independence involved so that it's not something that's completely shaped by a candidate like a television ad or even a campaign rally where the candidate and their campaign team really gets to shape the message and control the questions that are asked and the event. You know, these debates are a chance where a candidate and their opponent go head to head. They might have to answer some difficult questions. They might have to defend their record. There might be some unexpected moments. And so it's this idea when it goes well that it's the chance for the public and the voters to get insight into these candidates that isn't just completely rehearsed and thought out. And so it's frustrating, but the Idaho debates are not new. They're a partnership, like I said, between Idaho Public Television, the Idaho Press Club, the League of Women Voters, and Idaho's public colleges and universities. And they've been held for more than 30 years. And it was really interesting. I was looking back through my notes from the spring when I talked with Betsy Russell. But Governor Little was the first incumbent governor seeking re-election to not participate in the debates in 30 years when he mm-hmm. did it in the spring. And he's doing it again this fall. I talked to his campaign spokesman, his campaign manager, and he said, look, we believe that Idahoans know Governor Little and know his record. And so we think it's clear where the governor stands. But I thought it was disappointing. I thought it's going to be less information for voters heading into the important elections. And, you know, one thing the campaign talked about, people, their position is that people know Governor Little and where he stands. But I would say that Idaho is one of the very fastest growing states in the country. We were sorting through some mm-hmm. census data. And over the last 10 years, I think 21% of Idahoans are new to the state completely in the last 10 years. And so I don't know that completely checks out, that everybody knows who Governor Little is and knows what they get with the governor. And so I think a missed opportunity there to give some information to the voters ahead of a big important election coming up on November 8th.
And Gemma,
go ahead, Scott.
Just to piggyback, I totally agree with everything that Clark said for all those reasons. And I would add another one. We had a reader write a letter to the editor this week talking about younger voters. So here are voters who are, we're trying to get them to participate in the process and vote and get mm-hmm. out and vote. And some are turning 18 or or maybe new to the state, and to send this message that the incumbents aren't going to participate in a debate to inform the voters is really just another black mark in this whole debate.
I think it's fair to say that, frankly, it's selfish of incumbents not to do this. I mean, we go back to what Governor Little said in the spring when he decided not to debate. You know, his campaign put a news release out, quote, saying those historic accomplishments and facts are non-debatable. And they were talking about his proven track record. Well, they are debatable because not everyone agrees with the governor, agrees with incumbents, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. And so, I mean, Clark, this goes back to this whole idea, too, of transparency and being willing to defend the decisions that you have made in office.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you're exactly right on. You know, for a long time, it was looked at as part of the job, getting information out to the voters and the public, no matter whether it's not an enjoyable experience or you would prefer to do something else, or you would prefer to control the message within your own campaign, you know, whatever the case may be. But yeah, I agree that, you know, and I like what Scott said about the younger voters and transparency mm-hmm. in government and getting people involved. I talked with Jacqueline Kettler, who's a political science at Boise State University, and she said that, you know, there is some concern, especially because this appears to be a little bit of a trend right now. We're not just seeing it in Idaho, we're seeing it across the country. Earlier this spring, the Republican National Committee decided to withdraw from the presidential commission for debates. And so it's not something that we're just seeing in Idaho. It's happening across the country. But Dr. Kettler from Boise State expressed some concern about what would happen if this trend continued and if debates essentially went away. And for all the reasons that you talked about, and another reason, Dr. Kettler talked about just having a debate raises awareness about an election that's coming up. It raises awareness about the issues, the candidates. You know, it's a good reminder that this is coming up. And so it really gets people thinking about elections, which in turn gets them thinking about making a plan to vote. And so it's unfortunate. But yeah, just to recap, Governor Little and our incumbent U.S. House of Representative members, Russ Fulcher and Mike Simpson, declined a debate. And so those debates are canceled. But luckily, we do have a couple of debates coming up in Idaho. We have four coming up in Idaho, in fact, that have been scheduled. They start October 3rd and October 4th. We actually are going to have an attorney general's debate featuring Raul Labrador, the Republican nominee, and Democrat Tom Arcush. The next day on October 4th, we're going to have a U.S. Senate debate. U.S. Senate Senator Mike Crapo, Republican from Idaho, is going to debate two of his opponents, Democrat David Roth and Independent Scott Cleveland. And then a little bit later in October, on the 24th, we'll have our Superintendent of Public Instruction debate with Republican Debbie Critchfield and Democrat Terry Gilbert. And then finally, on October 28th, the last debate, which I think will be a good one and is a good race, the Idaho Lieutenant Governor's debate that features Republican nominee Scott Bedke and Democrat Terry Pickens Manweiler. So luckily, we do have candidates in four races who do agree about the importance of debates and do agree about the importance of sharing their vision and goals and policy priorities. And so I am looking forward to those four debates that will be coming up in October.
And I want to stick with the election thing, and let's head over to East Idaho, because Nate, some big changes coming to Bonneville County. It's opened a new election office, but one of the key features, Nate, is enhanced security. Can you talk a little bit more about this?
This is a new building that Bonneville County Elections have moved into, and they're really trying to drill the principle home that they want voters to know that this election is going to be secure. It's now a two-story building. They've put in cameras everywhere. There's motion sensors everywhere. They actually did a big media tour of this building and saying that every single place that voters go, the ballots are scanned and they're immediately put in a locked Ziploc bag. They are then transported to the election office, the main headquarters, on election day. And nobody, no election workers, can leave that building until, you know, the end of the day, till all of the ballots are counted. And then those are stored for, I believe, up to 2 years in case there's any sort of question. So Bonneville County is trying to get ahead of the election and try to, you know, let voters know that they're taking security issues seriously. They're opening up the building to the public, which, you know, in the 7 years I've worked here, they've never done that before. So it's kind of reassuring that the public can see how the process works in case there are any questions in the future. And they're letting the people see it, you know, experience it. And they're upping security to keep in line with the legislative laws that have been passed.
Rachel, I want to talk a little bit about affordable housing. As we know, this is a major issue across the country and right here in our own backyard. You recently reported on the Meridian City Council basically sounds like almost having a crisis of conscience, really, when in regards to how they're trying to figure out their role when it comes to affordable housing.
Yeah, absolutely. And this has been really interesting to me to watch because, you know, the last several years we've seen the city of Boise, you know, launching all kinds of programs, you know, like setting aside city-owned land for projects, and they're doing a whole zoning code rewrite to allow for higher densities. So, you know, that's kind of interesting to compare to, you know, neighboring Meridian, you know, also a really, you know, big size city in Idaho. And, you know, they have, you know, nothing in place really. And this, you know, the effort to try to figure out what the city's role is in providing housing, you know, really came about during the budget cycle when Jesse Tree came to the city council to ask for you know, them to put a budget line for donations to Jesse Tree, you know, because they help families in Meridian facing homelessness and avoiding eviction. And then they got another request from the housing company, which is affiliated with Idaho Housing and Finance Association. And, you know, that was to build actual affordable housing. So, you know, they've had these requests and some of the members of the city council were kind of like, you know, these are not going to slow down as we've seen, you know, they're only going to increase. So, you know, they had a presentation about trying to figure out what their role is. And it's pretty divided. You know, we have two council people who are pretty outspoken, Councilwoman Liz Strader, who, you know, said that affordable housing is obviously a problem. Homelessness is on the rise in the Treasure Valley. And, you know, she wants to do something. Councilman Joe Borton said the same thing, but, you know, they're kind of grappling with what to actually do and whether, you know, that's something that they directly fund housing or whether it is through, you know, things like zoning or requiring developers to set aside something for affordable housing. So, they're still working on that, and Councilwoman Jessica Perot is kind of leading that. She has a real estate background, so, you know, she's really interested in trying to find ways to, you know, compromise with the city council and you know, try to get something, you know, whether it's just a budget line every year to donate to a nonprofit, but so yeah, that's kind of in the works, and, you know, Meridian, while it doesn't, you know, have the same visibility of the homeless population that Boise has, you know, Jesse Tree says that they actively help like 40 families who are homeless or, you know, going through the eviction process. So, you know, I think that's something that the city needs to realize, you know, as it grows, you know, it's going to have these issues.
Well, and Rachel, I think you bring up a good point where, you know, the housing crisis may look different in Meridian as compared to Boise, right?
Yeah.
In Meridian, it probably is more families. And so how do you then, as Meridian continues to grow and more families continue to move to that area, how do you figure out where your responsibility lies as a local government?
Yeah. And, you know, that I think the next step for the city is to come up with data to, you know, back this up. And I think the key to, you know, where they're going to find the issues is talking to schools, because like you mentioned, you know, there are a lot of families in Meridian and, you know, school counselors and staff, you know which kids are, couch surfing, sleeping in their cars. So, you know, I think it's, you know, I'm glad the city is, you know, just even putting its feelers out, because I think that, you know, it's going to bring in a lot more information than the city has right now. And, you know, I mean, we've seen what the city of Boise has done. So it will be interesting to see what the city, you know, decides to do. And I think it's also interesting because, you know, we've seen developers, you know, kind of build some affordable housing here and there. But, you know, I think a lot of the experts I've talked to say that, you know, there needs to be something from the city to get, you know, to meet the need of the affordable housing that we need here.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of housing, I mean, there's so much construction going on all around Idaho. But Scott, there is a lack of workers when it comes to certain construction jobs. And in fact, what, there was a construction job fair recently?
Yeah, Boise State University has a pretty robust construction management program, and they held an annual job fair. I figured I'd go down and just check it out. And because right now, and I've been writing about the labor shortage in the United States, which is going on for a number of reasons, but we basically have nearly 11 million job openings, but we only have about 6 million unemployed workers available to take those jobs. So we have a real serious shortage, and construction jobs is definitely takes a big hit in this labor shortage. And so I spoke with a bunch of companies. There were 83 companies that showed up and 300 students showing up at this career fair. And particularly for these management jobs. So these are project engineers and superintendents and in these management roles, mm-hmm. scheduling and procuring materials and that kind of a thing, and lining up subcontractors. And kids right out of college can make anywhere from $70,000 to $80,000, $90,000 right off the bat going into a construction management job. And I spoke with one gentleman from Baker Concrete Construction. He flew in from Houston looking for workers. They've had really great success at Houston State. He said he's got at least 80 management job openings in his company. And they're a national company, so they're pretty big. And then he's got hundreds of non-management openings. So construction, you know, kids, if you want to go make some money, construction is really booming and they're looking for workers, and the Boise State program really is going gangbusters.
Wow. And that is not a shabby paycheck right out of college, for sure.
Yeah, I would have taken that.
Yeah, I would have too. Yeah, you don't make that in journalism, just FYI.
That's right.
Madeline, national parks really have become so popular, in particular during the pandemic. People wanted to, you know, get out, and this was a good opportunity, which means more and more people are visiting. But does that equate to more money being spent at these parks?
Oh, yeah. No, it absolutely. Like, the visitorship correlates pretty closely to the amount spent. And recently, we've got the 2021 numbers back as far as how much people spent and how many visitors were at what are called National Park Service units, which includes like national parks, but also forts and historical locations and reserves and all sorts of stuff. And so at those, they spent $20.4 billion nationwide. It's still a little bit down from 2019's numbers. So we had 2019 and then we had a huge slump in 2020, and then 2021. We've seen a lot coming back. Now, looking at Idaho specifically, Idaho had the least money from National Park Service units in the region, notably because we don't have a national park. But we do have several other, you know, spaces within Idaho that are managed by the National Park Service, which includes, you know, the Nez Perce National Historical Park. We've got Craters of the Moon National Monument Reserve, City of Rocks, Hagerman Fossil Beds, and those have pulled in a bit of money, and they've all kind of performed a little bit differently during all this. So, you know, with as far as the Nez Perce National Historical Park, that they have the most visitors and have got the most money of any National Park Service unit in Idaho. And so in 2021, that equated to about, you know, like it equated to several million dollars. But then you look at other locations like Cradle to the Moon. They also got $10.5 million from 2021 spending. And then you look at, you know, Hagerman Fossil Beds, and that was $536,000. Hagerman Fossil Beds really dropped off from 2017 to now, the number of visitors there. So even during the pandemic, like before it in 2019, they had an extreme drop off. So that's interesting. But all that's to say, you know, all of these National Park Service units in Idaho still brought in $37 million last year.
Wow.
But then you look at, you know, Yellowstone. And again, this is numbers to 2021. And right. Clark, please jump in if you'd like to, because when I mention Yellowstone, Yellowstone as of last year, 2021, you know, had a banner year. It had 4.8 million people visiting. It had, you know, it had the spending was up to $630 million. Which, you know, after everything is taken out, that equates to about $294 million in income. But this summer, you know, there was flooding, there were closures, there were partial closures. We have had a slump in the last couple months of visitorship there. So, it will be, and Clark has reported on this, it has been interesting to see, it'll be interesting to see what that looks like next year when we see these like income and spending numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Madeline, yeah, you're exactly right. I did a little bit of reporting on Yellowstone this summer, but visitation is down about 33% so far in 2022 compared to 2021. A lot of that is attributed to the historic flooding that occurred in June. You know, park officials closed all entrances to Yellowstone. They evacuated visitors. There were roads that were washed out, power lines that were down. And the park reopened, but even today, you know, months and months later, still two of the entrances are closed, the north entrance and the northeast entrance in Montana there. But it has been interesting. But 2021 was a record year for visitation at Yellowstone, but down a little bit this year because of the flooding, but still a great time to visit Yellowstone. And they do expect those numbers to rebound.
Clark, I want to talk about not just wildfire season, but how that impacts air quality. And you have just done an investigation into this. This is a real serious issue in regards to air quality.
Yeah, absolutely. I teamed up with Audrey Dutton from the Idaho Capital Sun, and we have a brand new story out that's at our homepage, idahocapitalsun.com today. Thank goodness the air quality is better than it was 3 or 4 weeks ago when we started mm-hmm. working on this story. But people may not know that Idaho actually has the most active large wildfires in the country right now, according to the National Interagency Fire Center, which is based in Boise, just outside the Boise airport. There are 40 large fires burning in Idaho today, including the large Moose Fire just outside of Salmon there. But what Audrey and I did is take a look at how increases in wildfire smoke affect the air quality in bad ways. But Audrey did a really cool graphic where she looked at the air quality index for Boise, Idaho, and you can actually click around on it on the story and pick other cities and other areas. But it shows that it's gotten pretty much continuously worse since the 1990s into the 2000s, and it's just been really bad, spiking to unhealthy air and very unhealthy air. It's a cool graphic that kind of puts that into perspective. But Audrey also looked at a 2020 study that was led by researchers out of the University of Montana, and that study talked about how there are signs that air quality is improving in the U.S. because of a reduction in industrial and vehicular emissions. But in the West, in places like where we live in Idaho, the air quality has gone down and is projected to get worse each year because of the wildfire smoke. Audrey also talked to an emergency physician and a pulmonologist who talked about mm-hmm. the health risks with bad air quality and are essentially asking people to stay inside and avoid strenuous activity when it's bad. But luckily, it's better than it was 3-4 weeks ago when it was really, really bad in Idaho. But the study or the story today kind of looked at, you know, as we see more wildfire because of climate change and other factors, we're going to continue to likely see bad air quality in Idaho and in the West. And there's a link to that study. There's some interviews with doctors from St. Alphonsus and St. Luke's. And there's that cool chart where you can plug in different metro areas, including Boise, but also Lewiston, Coeur d'Alene, Twin Falls, and take a look at the air quality going back from 1980 through 2020 and really looking at seeing it spike to unhealthy and very unhealthy levels over the last 10 years. Kind of gross to think about, but cool data and some interesting numbers there.
Well, and Clark, I mean, it's one of these things where too, how lucky were we this year that we really only had those couple of days of bad smoke in the Treasure Valley. I know it was different in other parts of the state. Because last summer, you could barely go outside almost the entire summer. We had such horrible air quality.
Yeah, last summer was bad. And then our data shows that 2017 was the worst year that it had been in a long time in Idaho. But yeah, we were lucky. We had kind of a wet, cool spring that delayed the start of the fire season. And we just had so far, just a few really, really bad days a few weeks ago. But, you know, unfortunately, it looks like with climate change, with increased fire risk and activity, that air quality is going to be something that we're going to contend with and confront into the future. And these studies and these experts say that it's likely to get worse in hand with fire danger getting worse. And so it's something to watch out for sure. But luckily, it wasn't just terrible this summer. We have had a break recently and some bad days 3-4 weeks ago, but it's something to continue to watch out for.
Yeah. Well, as always, I want to thank all of you for all of the reporting that you do, but also taking time out of your busy schedules to come on our program. So we appreciate all of you. We've been talking with Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, Scott McIntosh, the opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman, Nate Eaton, news director at eastidahonews.com, Rachel Spacek with the Idaho Statesman, and our own Madeline Beck, Mountain West News Bureau reporter with Boise State Public Radio. Thanks, everyone, and have a really good weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gemma.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for this episode of Idaho Matters. Thanks so much for listening. And just a reminder, you can find all of our episodes wherever you get your podcasts.